The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The first and foremost thing we should do is make it clear how outrageous this decision was and how much it impacts not just on woman's right to choose, which is a critical, critical piece, but on privacy generally. On privacy generally. And so I'm going to be talking to the governors as to what actions they think I should be taking as well. And but the most important thing to be clear about is we have to change, I believe we have to codify Roe v. Wade in the law. And the way to do that is to make sure the Congress votes to do that. And if the filibuster gets in the way, it's like voting rights, it should be, we provide an exception for this, require an exception to the filibuster for this action.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Ah, your Catholic president. Anything and everything to keep human sacrifice alive and well in this country. I mean, abortion is so sacred to so many. It's really hard for me to get my head around. I just do not understand. I don't get it. How people can be so blind to the reality that there is a human and an innocent life that we're talking about here. But there's a great blindness, that's for sure. That was the president yesterday. He was at NATO's, it was during a NATO conference. And President Biden said that he would support changing the Senate filibuster rule to make an basically make an exception for legislation ensuring privacy rights and access to abortion. And that's really an unprecedented step. I mean, the president took an unprecedented step yesterday of directly criticizing a co-equal branch of government on foreign soil. Have you thought about that for a minute? I mean, that's my takeaway. Let's take politics, let's take partisanship, let's take all that out. Let's just look at this today on such a patriotic weekend and such a wonderful time of the year as we celebrate the greatness of America, you know, as we celebrate our independence and the values that made this country great. On foreign soil, he directly criticized an equal branch of government. He was at this NATO summit in Madrid, certainly isn't the place to be talking about the Supreme Court decision, right? Not that they don't have any clue, but, you know, I don't think it resonates the same way as it does here in the States. It has nothing to do with our international defenses. And he criticized the Dobbs decision, saying that the court has thrust a serious problem upon the United States. More importantly, he called the Senate to suspend the filibuster rule so that they can pass a bill enshrining Roe into law. So up until now, you know, President Biden, as you have heard, I'm sure, he opposed changing the filibuster rules. You know, at one point in time, he says, that's a boneheaded idea. Right now, apparently, his views on life has changed. His views on the filibuster have changed. You know, he wants them suspended for this one time, just this one time, to pass this one bill. Well, why just this one time? Why not some other bill? Well, why not something else that comes down the road that you're personally passionate about? And again, this confusion, all done on foreign soil in front of our allies. It's like having house guests over, you know, and talking about personal finance, you know, or family problems, right? I mean, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. Again, I just call you. My heart is filled with love for Joe Biden. I know my words may not sound that way sometimes. As a Catholic, I'm just frustrated when my faith is attacked, when so many are led in scandal, when so many are led astray, when our nation really betrays the values that have made us great. We've always upheld individual freedom and liberty and life. We spilled, you know, American blood and treasure for those values. And today we've got leadership that tramples on that stuff. I'm sorry, it bothers me. It just bothers me. I'll leave it at that. All right, I don't want to get too deep into it. So just food for thought. Yesterday at noon Eastern time, Ketanji Brown Jackson was sworn in as the 116th Supreme Court Justice. And this came just shortly after Justice Stephen Breyer officially retired from the bench. And Jackson's place on the court, you know, it's not going to sway the votes one way or the other since, you know, she's a liberal representing a liberal. But her place on the court, of course, is historic. And here's just a little from CBS, give you a little more on what just went down.
After 28 years on the court, Justice Stephen Breyer is stepping down, turning his seat over to his former law clerk, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and make history as the first black female justice ever to serve on the Supreme Court. Now, Breyer, who at 83 years old is the court's oldest justice, sent President Biden a letter yesterday saying it has, quote, been my great honor to participate as a judge in the effort to maintain our Constitution and the rule of law. But this will not change the balance of the court. It still has six conservative justices, three liberals. Jackson, like Breyer, expected to be a reliable liberal vote. But, you know, she is certain to have an impact on the court, on the law, and really as a role model for young women and girls. And, of course, she is stepping into a deeply divided court last week, overturning Roe versus Wade and ruling in a more conservative direction in other cases, from guns to school prayer. And then the court wrapping up its term with more decisions that could have wide-ranging implications on climate change and immigration.
Congratulations to her, though. She did make history, and of course, her place on the court is historic. She's now the first black woman to serve there, and that was actually the main criteria that the president used for naming a replacement for Breyer. And just as a side note, again, I think that's a terrible reason to choose somebody. You choose somebody because of the color of their skin, not because of their judicial expertise or their history or the intellect or the life experience that you bring, just simply because of the color of their skin. And that's what he came out and said before, you know, his nomination process. He wanted to do this. He likes to make first, wants to make history. And I have no problem. I don't care what color your skin is. I just want the most unbiased, fair, intelligent Supreme Court justice there can be, one who can look at the law and not allow liberal or conservative agenda to influence their decisions. I just want them to interpret the law in a spirit of honesty and intellectual truth. That's what I want. Again, that's where we are today. Everything is about race. It's about gender. It's about abortion. I just wish we could get down to the basics. I don't care about a person's skin color. I really don't. I don't think that should be a criteria for nominating anyone, whether they're white or black or whatever. Jackson's confirmation hearings, though, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, it became the subject of a lot of memes. She was asked by Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, and you probably remember this. Remember that meme that went around? Can you provide a definition for the word woman? I can't answer that. And she's stammering about why not? You know, this is an answer coming from somebody who graduated magna cum laude from Harvard. So I have total respect for her intelligence, right? But you can't answer what a woman is, you know? You are the former supervising editor of the Harvard Law Review. Can I provide a definition? No, I can't. Not in this context. I'm not a biologist. And that was a cop-out. You're a woman. Define what a woman is. I'm a man. I'll tell you what a man is, right? There's certain biology that can certainly indicate, and there are markers that would point to that. But that's ridiculous. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. A couple of weeks ago, a number of Democrats actually wrote to Google. They were asking them to suppress results for crisis pregnancy centers when people type the word in abortion. I don't know if you heard this or not. Again, we live in a strange time. I mean, social media and the internet has really changed the way people get their information. Think of how newspapers are dying off. Look at how news has changed, right? People go to the internet and social media for most of their info. So Google asking people to suppress results for crisis pregnancy centers, that's outrageous. Those organizations help women in need. So if somebody types in the word abortion, they're not going to come and find a crisis pregnancy center, but you'll find a place you can terminate your child. The letter from 21 Democrats, including Dianne Feinstein, Bernie Sanders, he was one, another one, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, they asked only for suppression of results, but according to Reason Magazine, that Google attached some sort of disclaimer to the crisis pregnancy centers that appeared in the results. Now the New York Attorney General is demanding that Google do the same thing. New Yorkers and others traveling to the state should trust Google Maps is going to provide, you know, accurate information for them to get, quote, real safe care. You know, basically, a.k.a. abortion. My office will do whatever it takes to work with Google to make sure these changes ensure that people can locate reproductive care facilities that they need. As if those crisis pregnancy centers are doing something evil. I mean, they're there to help a woman. They're there to give them what the pro-death camp loves to use as a mantra, choice, right? You come there for a choice to find care and aid and information, to get sonograms, you know, to have another alternative other than terminating your child and suffering the psychological and emotional damage that comes from that. So the government pressuring private companies to control certain aspect of speech, I'm sorry, that is really, really disturbing to me. That's really disturbing. I want to put it on your radar. I just want to get you up to speed on that. Maybe a little bit later, you know, if I think about July 4th, I think about Independence Day. You know, virtue and freedom, they are critical for the success of this great nation of ours. You know, and John Paul II, he spoke so eloquently on what true freedom was all about. He says there's no freedom without truth. There can be no rule of law unless citizens, especially leaders, are convinced that there is no freedom without truth. We don't see that today, do we? When you see government officials and when you see others trying to ultimately mute truth and advance their agenda. This is America. We're a great nation. Let's continue to pray for it. In fact, today's also the anniversary. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this or not. July 1st through the 3rd in 1863 was the Battle of Gettysburg. And I thought I'd share with you a conversation I had recently with John Cribb. He's an Abraham Lincoln expert. There's been a lot of anti-American sentiments out there. In recent days, you can take a look at the divide in our country from partisan politics to rioting to life. How do we celebrate our country's founding during these divisive times? And what do we do when our fellow countrymen belittle and bemoan this great nation? Listen to this.
Look, a mayor didn't want to open a city council meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance because he claimed it was divisive, right? A famous singer says that she wants to change the flag to represent all Americans, even though it's the flag that Latinos and Blacks and Native American and people of other all races have all fought under from at least the Civil War on down. So what did our greatest president think about that? You just heard in the news roundup there, presidential historians ranked Abraham Lincoln as the greatest of all of our presidents. What would Lincoln think about what's going on today? What did he think about the sense of patriotism in our country? He actually warned against letting the spirit of 1776 slip away. But that's something that seems to be happening as we approach, believe it or not, the 250th anniversary of independence from Britain. So thinking about this, I thought, you know, let's talk to John Cribb. He's been with me many times. He is one of my favorites. He's an expert on Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote a novel. You might want to check it out. I know a lot of people have already picked it up. It's called Old Abe, and you can find him at johncribauthor.com. That's his website, but it's always good to get his perspective on this. And John, I'm grateful for your time. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for having me again. It's always great to be with you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, as I see what's happening in the culture at large, the disrespect for the flag, for the nation, even for the presidency in some respects, for our country, we're about to celebrate Independence Day. You know, we are, without question, the greatest nation in the world. The liberties that we have, the opportunities that we afford, more people want to come to this nation than any other nation on the planet. And as I was evaluating this, thinking about the 4th, I thought about you and Abraham Lincoln. Why did Lincoln, you know, in 1863, 1865, whenever he said it, why did he warn that, you know, there's a danger of us losing that spirit of 1776? And why is that so important today?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. He did. And he did it more than once, but he did it as early as, believe it or not, 1838, when he was still a young man, and he had just moved to Springfield, Illinois, brand new state capital of Illinois, and to start his law practice. And he gave a speech to a group called the Young Men's Lyceum. It's kind of a civic club. and he talked about this very issue, and he warned against the spirit of 1776 fading away. And one of the things he talked about was, he says, at that time the founding generation had really much passed away. He used a couple of very interesting metaphors. He said that that founding generation had been like a forest of mighty oaks, he said, but the hurricane of time had swept over it and felled most of those trees, and there are only one or two lonely trunks standing, he said. And he said, as the country moves farther and farther away from the Revolutionary War, that memory fades and the connection to it naturally fades. It grows more and more dim, he said. And he used another interesting metaphor. He said that the founders were the pillars of the Temple of Liberty, and now that they had crumbled away, then that temple would fall unless we put something in their place. And he said, we can't count on putting other leaders in their place, because we may have good leaders and or we have bad leaders from time to time, but he said we can put something else in there to uphold that Temple of Liberty. He said it, we need to count on the general intelligence of the American people, number one, and number two, the sound morality of the American people, and then number three, a reverence for the Constitution and the laws. So general intelligence, sound morality, and a reverence for the Constitution and laws. And he's talking about, in part, education, including civic education and good education in history. Does that raise any red flags today? Right. And he's talking about patriotism and instilling a love of the country in people. And again, boy, the red flags go up when you hear the examples you just gave a minute ago. And he knew that every generation had to rededicate itself to the spirit of 1776 and our founding principles. That's the only way the country survives. It's the only way. If we don't pass along the spirit of 76 and a love and devotion to those founding principles, we lose the country. Lincoln, in that speech, he said, if America is going to fall, it's not going to be from some foreign power destroying us. He said it's going to come from within. He said, if destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its author and finisher. So he, from a pretty early age, realized and was warning about this kind of thing that we're seeing today.
It is pretty amazing if you just think about the dates. You know, we celebrate independence July 4th, 1776, and he was saying this in 1838. So that was not a very long time to have that type of view. And we see the division that the country would endure, you know, with the eruption of the Civil War and so much more.
Yeah.
July 4th, 1776, still one of the most important days in history. There's no doubt about it. How do you view us today? And how would Lincoln view where we are in our current culture? You know, there's such disrespect, such loss of patriotism.
Yeah.
And I don't like the broad brush, because, I mean, there's so many wonderful people who serve our nation in so many different areas. But I see great disrespect for this nation. I don't know whether Americans are just taking this for granted, the freedoms they have. They don't know what it's like to go through a war or to have to bleed for the liberties that we enjoy. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that he would be alarmed and discouraged by some of what we're seeing today, because he considered it an important holiday. He gave another speech in 1858, so 20 years later. Kind of on the eve of the Civil War. He gave in Chicago in July of 1858, just a few weeks before the start of the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates. And he talked about the 4th of July and why it was important. And he said, we hold these celebrations to remind ourselves exactly what that great founding generation accomplished. He said, all the good that has come from that generation, the freedom and opportunities we enjoy today. And he said, we celebrate the 4th to remind ourselves how we are historically connected to it. And he said, those celebrations on Independence Day should leave us feeling more attached to one another and more firmly bound to the country we inhabit. In other words, again, the 4th of July should build patriotism, love of country. And Lincoln knew that the 4th of July celebrations are or should be part of the glue that holds us all together, and it should remind us how difficult it was to establish, secure the principles and rights and freedoms underlying our democracy, and preserve and protect them over the years, and expand them to larger groups of people. Yeah. And the Independence Day celebrations, properly observed, should help us remember to be grateful to live here, and remember how every generation has a responsibility to preserve our rights, freedoms, and pass them on to the next generation. So Lincoln knew it's not all just about fireworks and throwing burgers on the grill. There's some very important stuff lying just underneath the surface of the 4th of July, and he knew that.
It's so true. You know, we live in a time where we hear, you know, this constant mantra of how, you know, racism is alive and very vibrant in our country today. And of course, Lincoln, I'm sure he had a struggle with our founding fathers allowing slavery to exist while founding a nation that was it was based on the ideals of freedom and equality. And of course, he's the president who wrote the Emancipation Proclamation in the end. Is there a parallel there too? Let's go back to, tell me about Lincoln in regard to his vision of seeing all Americans as descendants of the founders and maybe his own struggle with slavery.
Yeah, well, he did view all Americans as descendants of the founders. And he, in that same speech of 1858, he called the founders iron men. It's a great expression, isn't it? Iron men. And he pointed out that very few of us, or few Americans even at that time, in 1858, were descended by blood or family from that founding generation, from those iron men, because so many immigrants were always coming into this this country, and of course more than ever today. But he said that when we read the Declaration of Independence, which was his favorite founding document, he went to it again and again, he see that when we read that, we realize that we have inherited the principles and rights and freedoms that those founders secured for us. And he said that Declaration is the electric cord, he called it, that links the hearts of liberty-loving people together. And he said, in that respect, we are all descendants of the founders. He said, it's as if we were all the blood of the blood and the flesh of the flesh of that founding generation, is the way he put it. No matter what our skin color or our politics or, you know, our family background, those principles are or should be what make us one American family and make us all descendants of that founding generation. The problem, of course, today is, as you say, is that there are a lot of people who don't want to look at it that way. They're spinning this narrative that it was just a bunch of white guys who talked about freedom and liberty, but established racism and slavery instead.
My guest today is John Cribbs. If you want to join us, it's toll free 888-914-9149. When we come back, we'll look at what sort of 250th birthday celebration our country's headed for. That's right around the corner. There's a lot unfolding every day in the culture, and I'm hoping that that's going to be a spectacular patriotic event for our nation. Plus, on this day, something very significant had occurred, and Abraham Lincoln had his fingers on it. I'll tell you about it when we come back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
It's like a civics class on the radio. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's great to be with you today. You know, I love our country, and I love sharing our history and our faith together with you. It's so important. And speaking today with one of my favorites, he's an expert on Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote a wonderful book that you could check out. It's actually a novel. It's called Old Abe, all right? And former Vice President Mike Pence, he called it the best Lincoln book he ever read. And former U.S. Secretary of Education William Bennett, Bill Bennett said, you got to read it, right? And it is a good read. I actually have it. And if you have a love for Abraham Lincoln, I think you'll appreciate it. You know, I invited John to stop by today. John Cribb joins me. He and his website, if you do want to get plugged into him, johncribbauthor.com, I believe is the website from the top of my head here. But we were talking a little bit about where we are as a country and Lincoln's insight into the 4th of July. He always believed it was important for Americans not to lose the spirit of 1776. It was important for Americans to pay tribute to Independence Day. And he said that as early as 1838, according to John. And we are about to celebrate, as I was sharing with you not too long ago, a significant milestone for America. We're approaching the 250th anniversary for this young nation, We're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of our independence from Britain in 5 years. And I remember the bicentennial celebration. I can only imagine what's going to happen on the 250th celebration. It's going to be something else. And John, I'd love your take on that too. It's good to have you back. There's so much going on, from Black Lives Matters to critical race theory to all these other issues that are infiltrating, American schools and streets. What sort of celebration, 250th birthday celebration, do you think that the country's going to have in 2026? I'm hoping it's going to be a moment of great unity and patriotism, but I'd love your analysis.
Yeah. Well, me too, but it's a great question. Who knows? Who knows? It's hard to believe we're just 5 years away, but yeah, you're right. It's the semi-quincentennial, believe it or not. That's the word. I think it's so hard to say. It's centennial is 100 quins. Yeah, quin is 5 in Latin, so, and semi is half of 500. So I think they're going to call it America 250 is what they've decided to call it. That's probably a good idea. But yeah. I'm like you. I remember the bicentennial just being such a grand celebration with, parades and tri-cornered hats and fireworks and tall ships. And I think even though the country had been through some tough years with Watergate and the Vietnam War and stagflation and, an oil crisis and all that, people came together to pay tribute to the founding and the Revolutionary War. You have to wonder. I'm worried about what it's going to be like unless something changes. And you've given a lot of great examples, and there are more that. And did you see what came out of the National Archives a few days ago? They formed a task force to advise them on racism at the archives, and the U.S. Archives task force.
I missed that. No, I didn't see that.
Look it up and read it. The report's online, and it says things like that rotunda, that beautiful room at the archives on Constitution Avenue, where thousands of tourists come, Americans, to see their founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, Constitution. Wow. They called it an example of structural racism, and said that trigger warnings should be put up. I guess I don't know what that means. Maybe signs saying "Warning: Founders ahead" or something. Who knows? But if this is the line of thinking that's going to carry the day, then I think that 5 years from now, that 250th anniversary may be just a year-long scowling at our nation's history. And that would be very wrong, because this country deserves a whole lot better than that. And, Drew, a nation that is taught to loathe itself and its own past is in deep trouble. It's in deep trouble. So
I agree.
Who knows? There is a commission for this, and there's some good people on that commission, like Tom Cotton and James Swanson, who's a great Lincoln historian. And hopefully the devil's always in the details, and we don't know what it'll be. I think we have to push back against all of this. We have to push back against it so that we don't have a rotten 250th birthday party.
I hope we're talking just a few years from now, months if you break it down that way. But there's this big push, as you know, for the 1619 Project, which argues that that's America's founding. It wasn't 1776. It wasn't a fight for independence. It wasn't the Revolutionary War, these beautiful documents penned by Thomas Jefferson. No, it was over the first enslaved Africans when they arrived in Virginia. And what we fought over really was about slaves. And I hope that and critical race theory and everything is behind us. And maybe this is a great time for our nation to heal. And I'm hoping that will be the case. You take a look at what happened, many years later in 1863. You and I were talking just briefly off air. So on this day that the Gettysburg battle erupted, the Battle of Gettysburg, July 1st through the 3rd. And if people aren't familiar with that, Gettysburg is a beautiful little town in Pennsylvania. I used to live in Pennsylvania. Of course, Union and Confederate forces met there, and the battle involved the largest number of casualties of the entire war. And it's often described as the war's turning point due to the Union's decisive victory. But a lot of blood spilled there. There was no doubt about it. And, of course, you are the Lincoln expert here. November 19th, 1863, Lincoln delivers that powerful speech known as the Gettysburg address there. And he wasn't, I didn't realize this, but I think you told me this before. He was not the feature orator that day. So maybe we can speak about that too. I mean, bring people up to speed in a little bit of American history today, the Battle of Gettysburg, and of course what Lincoln went through there and the import of that speech.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've kind of you know, until you said that, I did not put the date together, but you're right. July 1st was the first day of that three-day battle that Confederate and Union armies just kind of stumbled into each other by accident, and then it kept building and building. More troops kept pouring in, and you got this horrific battle culminating with Pickett's charge across the field there, and the destruction of the troops under his command, and then Lee has to retreat back. So it's the high water mark of the Southern Army as far as, you know, invading the North. And for your listeners who haven't been to Gettysburg, you know, go. It is such a moving place. Lincoln followed the battle as closely as he could through the telegraph wires from the White House, anxiously. You know, waiting news. And then finally the word comes through that George Meade, the commander of the Union Army, has prevailed. And then shortly after that, news comes that Vicksburg has fallen. Ulysses S. Grant has taken Vicksburg. So it's a big 1-2 punch to the gut of the South. And really, as you say, in a lot of ways, they didn't know it at the time, but it was a real turning point. But all of that leads to, as you say, several months later on November 19th, Lincoln giving the address at Gettysburg. He's invited to give a few remarks because the main speaker, Edward Everett, he ended up speaking for 2 hours, and Lincoln was just supposed to speak for a few minutes, and that's what he did. He first spoke for about 2 minutes, and at the dedication of the cemetery there, because they just had so many dead people, they had to do something with them, so they formed this national cemetery. But to bring it all back to, you know, to the founding, he begins that famous speech, maybe the greatest speech ever given on American soil, with the words 47 years ago. And he gave that speech in 1863, and 47 is 87 years. And if you subtract 87 from 1863, you get 1776. Oh, wow. And then he says, you know, he practically quotes the Declaration of Independence. He says our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So Lincoln once again goes back to the founding and the Declaration. And in that speech, he basically tells Northern people, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically says to them, we have to keep fighting this awful war to preserve and protect the founding principles, those principles that our the founding generation secured for us. And Lincoln knew that every generation in its own way has to fight to preserve those principles and pass them on. And that's what the 4th of July is all about.
You know, the speech itself, it was a short speech, wasn't it? The writing of that, did he do it on the train on the way out there? And you know, here's the president of the United States. There was a different person chosen to deliver the speech that day. Give me the background on that. I mean, what was it about this speech? Was it a one-pass thing? Did he labor on this? What do we know about it?
Yeah, he started it. He knew. He put some thought into it, and there's an old legend that he wrote the whole thing on the back of an envelope on the train on the way to Gettysburg.
Right, right.
Not true. There is some question as to how much he might have written it and worked on it on the train. On the way, he did not have it completed by the time he left Washington. He had started it, so he may well have worked on it somewhat on the train. But then when he got to Gettysburg, he stayed at the house of a family named Wills, and that night he worked on it. He really finished it up that night, and then went to bed. And the next morning, before he went out to the cemetery to give the speech, he made a fresh copy and made a few last changes. And then he toured the battlefield that morning, and because he had not seen it. And there was still the wreckage of war. You know, there were still, you know, skeletons of dead horses and old rusty, you know, muskets lying around and stuff. But then he gets in this parade, and a very somber parade. They go out the short ride out to the new cemetery, where he after Edward Everett gives the main remarks of the day, he gives these very brief remarks that they were, you know, by the time he finished, the crowd thought he was just getting going, and all of a sudden the guy's finished. But it certainly is. And another thing, I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners have done this, but if you haven't, go to the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and stand there and read the Gettysburg Address on the wall of that memorial. It's a moving thing to do.
Well, let's do this, John. We'll take a couple quick calls. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. If you're on hold already, I'll get you on there. I know several people want to join the conversation. I was always struck by this because that theme, the theme of the the speech, as you point out, the language of the Gettysburg Address, it wasn't new. I mean, in his July 1861 message to Congress, he referred to the United States as a democracy, a government of the people, by the same people. The radical aspect of this speech, though, began with Lincoln's assertion that the Declaration of Independence, and this is to your point about how important this celebration is, July 4th, 1776, he made this assertion that it was the Declaration of Independence and not the Constitution that was really the true expression of the Founding Fathers' intentions for their new nation. And I think that's something that's often overlooked.
Yes, you're right. It is overlooked. To Lincoln, the Declaration was the main founding document. And as I say, it was his favorite one, the one he went back to again and again, because it laid down those principles that we're all created equal and all endowed by our Creator with the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Those were the rights. That's what it was all about, and it's still all about. The Constitution is the vehicle that we set up to preserve and maintain and protect those rights. But they're spelled out there so beautifully in the Declaration. And so that is Lincoln's argument was that we had lost our way, that in the country, because of slavery, it had lost its way in its dedication to those ideals. And he said, we need to rededicate ourselves to the Declaration of Independence.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll take a few calls. Char, we'll grab her first. She's in Chippewa Falls. Novella, Mary Alice, everyone, we'll try to get you on the air if we can do that here. Char, good afternoon.
Hi. See, the country admires Abe Lincoln so much for his fight against slavery, as do I. I'd like to know what your guest thinks. Why do you think it is that the country does not seem to recognize the fact that 360,000 Northern soldiers, mainly white soldiers, fought for the end of slavery, also for the ideals of that independence?
Yes, and we do seem to forget that this country went to war to put an end to slavery, and a lot of people spilled blood and lost their lives. A lot of treasure and blood was spent to put an end to slavery. And Lincoln realized that the founding was a flawed founding, in that we founded the country and it was going to be a place where people were free and to govern themselves, and yet we had slavery. Lincoln's view was that the founding fathers knew slavery was wrong, but they couldn't break away from England, fight the greatest military power in the world, or set up a new nation and hold 13 very different states together and abolish slavery all at the same time. It was just too big a task. So what they could do, though, and did do, was lay down those principles in the Declaration of Independence we just talked about. And those principles spelled the doom of slavery. And they were a promise that slavery would end, in Lincoln's view. And that's what the Civil War became. It became a fight to redeem that promise. And you're right, people, today a lot of people seem to want to overlook the sacrifice that it took to redeem that promise.
All right, Novella is listening to us in Staten Island. Novella, good afternoon. You're on the air with John Cribb.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just listening. The gentleman was saying that the Declaration of Independence, that a lot of people think it was just written by a lot of old white guys, and I kind of missed what he said about that, and I would like to, could he just say that again briefly?
Sure.
About the...
John, you want to repeat what you said?
I think that's what I said, that the view is that the argument is that it was written by a bunch of old white guys, and some people will use that language, and that they talked a good game about freedom and equality, but in fact they set up a country that legalized slavery and instituted slavery and instituted racism. And so the argument is it wasn't that great a founding. Lincoln's answer was, you're right. It was a flawed founding, but it was a glorious start to a long journey that, in the end, brought freedom and hope to millions of people, both here and around the world. And I think that's the difference.
Okay, so I hear you are talking about, everybody's talking about slavery. I'm 80 years old, and I grew up, my first 40 years, I never really heard much about slavery. African Americans didn't want to talk about it. It was something to be ashamed of. But now lately, this is all you hear. Okay, so
yeah,
that was a terrible thing. But nobody talks about Jim Crow and how much has been denied African Americans. The greatest thing taken from African Americans, in my view, because I am a Christian, I love the Lord,
amen,
is that even Jesus was portrayed with blue eyes and blonde hair, and the church never repented from that myth.
All right. No, so, Novella, I'll tell you what. Hold the thought. Okay, I have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. My guest today is John Cribbs, Novella from Staten Island, raising some good points. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Taking a look today at, of course, the Battle of Gettysburg, Independence Day, as that's rapidly approaching. And one of the greatest presidents in American history, the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, welcome back. It is great to talk with you today. We're rapidly approaching the 4th, America's Independence Day, and taking a look today also at Gettysburg. It was on this day that the Battle of Gettysburg took place. It was a tragic moment, July 1st, 1863. A lot of lives were lost. It was a decisive moment in the battle, I should say. But yeah, when you think about the horror of the loss that took place and how gruesome that war was and what it was fought over, we remember Abraham Lincoln, who was the president at the time, delivered the great Gettysburg Address. And we're just talking about, if you're just joining me, our nation's freedom, the spirit of 1776, our presidents, in particular, Abraham Lincoln. And I've invited to join me today a very gifted author and a man who is an expert on Abraham Lincoln. John Cribb joins me today. And you can pick up his book if you want to read about it. Vice President Pence called it the best book he's ever read on Abraham Lincoln. It's called Old Abe. And John, I'm hoping I'm getting your web address right. It's johncribbauthor.com. Am I correct on that?
Yes, you're right. Somebody, I think it was a plumbing company in England or something like that, already had johncribb.com. I couldn't get that one.
It's impossible to get domain names anymore. It's so true. Of course, yeah, you can go to major bookstores and find it as well. Hey, when we had to take our pause, we were speaking to Novella, 80 years old, and lived through some dark chapters in you know, the 20th century. She saw the horror of Jim Crow and so many other things. And Novella, I'm going to let you restate, if you'd like, your question or comment to John, and then I'll let him respond, okay?
Yes. So I was saying that we're hearing a lot about slavery today. That was a horrible, terrible thing. But nobody talks about Jim Crow, all the things that happened afterwards, and what I consider the biggest terrible thing at all was the fact that Jesus has been portrayed to us as Caucasian for so many years. I didn't know until I was 40 years old and went to Israel in the middle of winter, and I saw the climate there, and I saw the sun, and I saw the people with their heads wrapped, that I realized that Jesus was not Caucasian, that Christianity didn't even come to Europe until, like, the year 800. Right. And even, and I'm just going to say this real quick, and even when I went to Russia twice on a tour with an educational group, and, of course, the churches were closed. It was under communism at that time, which was horrible. We took Bibles in, smuggled Bibles in. However, we went to the churches that were museums, and because the people had been illiterate back in those days, all the Bible stories was painted all over the walls. You could see every story. So this is how the peasants would know the different Bible stories about Lazarus. So I asked my tour guide, I said, how come all the pictures of all these people on the wall are black? And the tour guide said, oh, the wood got dark. And I said, did the hair get kinky? So I went to both of those places twice, to Israel twice. And to me, that is like the greatest sin of all. And the church has promoted this for years. It's
all right,
bad enough we felt less than, and to make even God, Jesus. Okay, that's it.
No, I get the point. Novella, I'm glad you called because I love it. And for those who don't know what Jim Crow laws are, too, let me just tell them that. And let's talk about why the art is perhaps white and in other places it's manifested differently. Jim Crow laws at the time were the state and local laws that enforced racial segregation in the southern part of our country. And it was horrible what took place. And she highlighted the horrors of that. Why aren't more people talking about that? But then Jim, of course, she went to the art. I tend to think people sometimes took artistic liberties. It's not right. I mean, clearly, you know, Christ, you know, we know where Israel was. He would be Middle Eastern in his look. So would the Virgin Mary. And so often Renaissance art, popular art, showed them very differently. But your thoughts and your comments for what Novella had to say.
Well, thank you, Novella. I mean, you make some excellent points. And Jim Crow, of course, Drew and I have been talking about the founding and kind of from Abraham Lincoln's perspective. Of course, he didn't know about Jim Crow. That was long after he was gone. It was a bad chapter in our nation's history. And but I would just point out that what in the end defeated Jim Crow was, again, those principles enshrined in the Declaration of Independence that in the end got rid of Jim Crow. And as I say, it's been a long struggle, and we're still on that road toward a more perfect union. I would gently disagree with the idea that nobody's really talking about Jim Crow these days, although unless you were talking about Drew and me, because we were talking at an earlier time.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of talk about Jim Crow. I have two daughters who just finished up high school and in college now, and believe me, they know a lot about Jim Crow. They study Jim Crow. Joe Biden seems to talk about Jim Crow all the time. What do you call Georgia's voting legislation, Jim Crow on steroids or something? Okay. I think the danger, I think people know about Jim Crow. I think perhaps...
It wasn't Rosa Parks to celebrate it recently, John?
I think I mean, everybody knows that Jim Crow was very, very wrong, and we're still living with the effects of Jim Crow, and that is a very important and fair point. But we don't live in a country that has Jim Crow anymore. And I think that sometimes in the public discourse, some of the voices talk and act as if this is still a Jim Crow nation. And that's just very, very wrong. We have come a long, long way toward that. Thanks to, again, our founding principles and the spirit of 1776.
I agree with that. So to her point with the art, I mean, it's surprising to a lot of people that you know, you grow up and you see the Virgin Mary is very light-skinned and Jesus, same way. And, you know, I was a documentary filmmaker, and I had traveled to different places around the world, and I did this documentary on these reported apparitions that were taking place. And, you know, when the Virgin Mary was appearing in, let's say, Africa, she appeared as an African woman. When she appeared in Asia, she appeared Asian. So, I think art sometimes takes on the flavor of the nation in which it's reflected, right?
Yeah, you see pictures of Jesus from the Renaissance from Flanders, and it looks like the Holy Land is a town somewhere in the Netherlands or something, right? And you know, I guess some people today would call that cultural appropriation. But I think that over the ages, artists around the world have depicted Jesus in the terms that they're familiar with, and you know, in some ways, you know, you could argue that. But on the other hand, you could also make the argument that that's an expression of the power of Christ in some ways, that he's come into every corner of the world. And if you go to Central America, he looks different than he does from an artist that might paint him in New York City. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a good thing.
Well, let's grab another call. We have a couple minutes left here. And Novella, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us here. Mary Alice, you're going to have to make it quick. Only a couple minutes here for you, but good afternoon.
Sure. Good afternoon, sirs. Abraham Lincoln was one of my favorite presidents when I read a biography of him in grade school. I've not read much about him, but anything I have read about him, it's extraordinary. My point being, I was probably about 25 or 30 at a family gathering, and my oldest brother was an Eagle Scout. His scoutmaster was invited to that same family gathering. We got on the subject about slavery. Mm-hmm. And all that the Scoutmaster said was, who sold the black man into slavery here to the United States? And of course, my parents knew what the answer to that question was, but the Scoutmaster was trying to get the rest of us youngsters to wake up and realize, yes, slavery is a bad thing. We don't like this, but who sold the black man from Africa into slavery here and other parts of the world? And we all had to kind of look at each other and say, okay, that's a very good point, that not a lot of people knew, or still, I would venture to say still today, do not know and realize the black tribal leaders of, you know, and I would assume it's still going on today, that this is still...
Mary Alice, I just got to leave it at that point. Of course, they worked in unison with so many of the horrific slave traders of the day. I appreciate it. My guest today was John Cribb. Always enjoyed talking to him. Author of Old Abe. And you can check him out at johncribbauthor.com. That's his website. When we return, we'll pray the chaplain. Stay with me.